Please be seated. Our next case for argument is 21-1381.
Our first case for argument
Aspen
this morning is 20-1046, Kyocera versus the ITC. Mr. Shulman, please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The Commission erred in its determination of non-infringement for two reasons. First, because it misconstrued the driven position, and second, because it erroneously...
You don't want to take your mask off?
With the court's permission, thank you. And second, because it erroneously excluded the doctrine of equivalence testimony of Dr. Pratt.
How do I pronounce your name?
Referring to the driven position. The driven position is the position near or at the bottommost traveled position, where the rotary member re-engages the driver member to lift it back up to its ready position. This is near or at the bottommost travel position because of recoil. There is a piston bumper, and in pages 1939 and 1940 of the record, it is admitted that every tool ever made has had this piston bumper, because otherwise tools would crash together, the whole thing would explode, you'd only be able to use it once. And once it recoils, and the evidence on 1935 of the record was that the accused tool recoils to 1/16th of an inch from the bottommost travel position. At that point, or at the bottommost travel position, the rotary member lifts it back up to the top, to the ready position. And if the court looks at page 51 of our reply brief, which is figure 20 from the 296 patent, and I'll refer to the 296 patent as representative of all of them, and look at that figure 20, that annotated figure 20, along with, and you can follow along in appendix 362, column 26, which is the description in the 296 patent of this particular drawing, and it's on lines, begins on lines 43. It says, referring to figure 20, the piston 458, so this is in the red box, is depicted near or at its bottommost travel position. And in this configuration, the displacement volume and the main storage chamber are at their largest combined volumes, while the cylinder venting chamber is at its minimum volume. This bottom position, referring to a position near or at the bottommost travel position, is also sometimes referred herein as the driven position. It goes on to say in figure 20, movable piston 458, this is the blue box, is now in contact with the station, I'm sorry, the piston 458, still in the red box, is now in contact with the stationary piston stop, that's the bumper, which is why the cylinder venting chamber is at its minimum or zero volume. If we're at its zero volume, it would be at its bottommost travel position, but it might not be zero. In figure 20, now at the blue box, the driver is also at its bottommost travel position, and its lowermost tip can be extending out the exit port. This demonstrates that the bottom position is near or at the bottommost travel position. In fact, everywhere in the patent in which the patentee wished to describe the bottommost travel position, it literally said bottommost travel position. The only time in the patent where it's referred to as a bottom position generally is when it describes the driven position as distinct from the bottommost travel position. And given the proper construction, I don't believe there's any dispute that that 1/16th of an inch difference was near the bottommost travel position, and therefore there would be infringement. Moving on to the doctrine of equivalence issue in Dr. Pratt.
What was Dr. Pratt going to testify as to the doctrine of equivalence? What was he going to say? Does the record show, did you submit a proposed testimony by him?
Yes, Your Honor. So that was, again, in the record around pages 1931 to 1940 is Dr. Pratt's description of Dr. Pratt's testimony. What the testimony would have been, and again, it depended on this driven position.
What volume is this? What volume are they appended?
Volume 2.
Would be, Your Honor, in volume 2 of the appendix. So again, it was in,
at what page?
From around 1931 to 1940, there is a description of what Dr. Valley, Dr. Pratt, and for that matter, Dr. Valley's testimony was surrounding the bottom position. Once the court had determined that the driven position meant at the bottommost travel position, at that point the testimony would have been that 1/16th of an inch difference would have been equivalent to that bottommost travel position. But what's interesting, Your Honor, I think, and what reflects why the court's, the commission's determination on Dr. Pratt's testimony was faulty, is there's an anomaly here. Because had the ALJ construed the bottom, the driven position at or near the bottommost travel position, the ALJ would have let Dr., and in fact did let Dr. Pratt testify as to literal infringement, he would have been able to testify that 1/16th of an inch is near the bottommost travel position. But once the ALJ ruled and the commission agreed that the bottommost, that the driven position is only the bottommost travel position, now it ruled, because of his lack of qualifications as being a literal person of ordinary skill in the art, that he could not testify that 1/16th of an inch was equivalent to the bottommost travel position. So you have these two, basically essentially the same testimony, that 1/16th of an inch was near, that he would have been allowed to testify, and 1/16th of an inch away was equivalent, which he wasn't allowed to testify.
Why should someone who isn't qualified as a skilled artisan be allowed to offer expert testimony on how a skilled artisan would view these factual questions?
Well, Your Honor, this court has never said that an expert has to literally be a person of ordinary skill.
No, we said they have to, at a minimum, possess the level of skill in the art of an ordinarily skilled artisan.
Well, Your Honor,
it would be impossible to find someone who literally meets the definition. An expert, by very nature of the word, would likely exceed the minimum level of qualification. So why should it be, though, someone who doesn't possess the minimum level of qualification should nonetheless be allowed to be testifying as an expert on factual matters?
I think, Your Honor, this court's decision in SEB provides a useful answer to that. In SEB, where the invention was a fryer, and the expert admittedly had no expertise in fryers, but the limitation in question had to do with polymers, and he was an expert polymer.
Yes, but in that case, the parties had a different level of ordinary skill in the art. The expert in that case was not excluded by virtue of failing to meet the level of skill in the art. In this case, you have a level of skill that's been decided as a factual matter, and your expert doesn't meet it. So the SEB case is irrelevant to that.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think SEB ever, I searched, SEB never refers to the level of ordinary skill in the art in the decision.
But that's exactly what distinguishes that case from this one, counsel. In this one, there is a clear assertion of what qualifies for a level of skill in the art, and there were those three different tiers of level, depending on whether you had a bachelor's, a master's, or a doctorate, but all of them required accompanying work in the particularized field.
Well, Your Honor, so Dr. Pratt's experience, and this is and this was all he lacked, the ALJ ruled, was experience. He had the education. But the issue was he had experience in fastener driving tools, and the question was, did he have experience in power nailers? And in Appendix 755, he gives his experience.
Yes, but now what you're suggesting is that we should disregard a level of skill in the art once it's ascertained or stipulated to, and that we should undertake some factual analysis of whether we in particular think somebody has enough relevant experience even though they don't meet the minimum standard. Is that how you would like future cases to proceed? It seems squishy and not very consistent with the whole FOCETA concept.
Well, Your Honor, admission of expert testimony is always reviewed for abuse of discretion. The court has discretion, and the court can ask, the district court can ask, whether or not this particular person is capable of testifying from the perspective of one having ordinary skill in the art. And in this case, the difference in the skill in the art, the qualifications of what he had, was minimal. That the ALJ let him testify as to literal infringement, saying, I believed it was a close call, and said that the only reason the ALJ did not let Mr. Pratt testify as to doctrine of equivalence is because he thought Aquatex forbid him from doing so.
Counsel, did you...
Go ahead.
Did you actually stipulate to the definition of faceta de remarkman or otherwise concede it?
The level of ordinary skill in the art?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. That was set forth in Markman, and we're not arguing to change the level of ordinary skill in the art ruling here.
Did you ever preserve an objection to it later? Or was it basically that we conceded it? And
we continue to argue it, Your Honor, but it's we believe it's irrelevant to the point. We believe it's not determinative of the point here, because his experience, which was years of designing pneumatic fasteners, including rivets, allowed him to testify from the perspective of ordinary skill in the art as to the particular equivalent in question, which is what SEB says. You look at his experience relevant to the equivalent in question, and nobody has raised any argument that because of his experience in pneumatic fastener drivers, like rivets, that he couldn't tell the equivalence of 1/16th of an inch from the bottommost travel position.
I believe that Judge Dyke was asking you a question a minute ago, which didn't get completed, but I believe I'm going to guess what the question was, and it is, doesn't Aquatex actually preclude this panel from doing exactly what you're seeking to do in this case? It seems quite clear to say the doctrine require that evidence be presented to the jury or other fact finder through the particularized testimony of a person of ordinary skill in the art. So
Your Honor,
doesn't that preclude, I mean, that is a case that binds this court and that we have to give binding precedent to. Doesn't that preclude exactly what you're asking us to determine in this case?
I see I'm in my rebuttal time, so I'd like to answer that question, Your Honor. First of all, I believe when it says of, if you look at the first sentence of that paragraph, it says, both the Supreme Court and this court have made clear the evidence of equivalence must be from the perspective of someone skilled in the art. For example, through the testimony of experts or others versed in the technology, which seems to be an expert who's not necessarily a person having ordinary skill in the art, but could testify from the perspective or by documents, so not even an expert, not a person, including texts or treatises. I think, Your Honor, that the word of is holding far too much weight in this circumstance. The rest of Aquatex is all about particularized linking testimony. In fact, Your Honor, I would argue, we do argue that the phrase that you're relying on in Aquatex was dicta. The court is not bound by that statement. The holding in Aquatex was that the CEO who gave generalized equivalence testimony did not give particularized linking testimony to the equivalent in question. That was the holding and why his testimony was excluded. It was an additional fact that he also didn't happen to be an expert, but the court had already determined that he didn't give particularized linking testimony, and the rest of Aquatex is all about the requirement for particularized linking testimony. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. If there are no further questions.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Shulman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is it Mr. Parikh?
Yes.
Am I saying that right? Okay.
May I remove my mask? Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. So I'd like to follow up on one thing Mr. Shulman said about how the district court can determine whether a person of ordinary, or whether an expert can testify from the perspective of one of ordinary skill in the art. And I believe he said that there was no finding in this case that Dr. Pratt could not testify from the perspective of one of ordinary skill in the art, but the record shows otherwise. At Appendix 1358, there was an issue during trial about whether Dr. Pratt could testify from the perspective of one of ordinary skill in the art. And Judge Bullock found below that, and he said, well, unfortunately, Order 28, I believe, has resolved that, so you're going to have to move on to another question. So there was a specific finding below that Dr. Pratt could not testify from one of from the perspective of one of ordinary skill in the art, and subsequently the discussion about Aquatex. I think Aquatex clearly demonstrates that evidence of equivalence has to be from, or has to have testimony from the perspective of someone skilled in the art. And here there is no question that Dr. Pratt did not meet that minimum level.
Okay, so apart from his testimony about the doctrine of equivalence, you're arguing that he should not have been able to testify as to other claim limitations, correct?
That's correct.
And it seems to me outside of the doctrine of equivalence area, let's take a hypothetical that the invention is an automobile with leather seats. One of the limitations is leather seats. Shouldn't someone under those circumstances who's an expert in leather be allowed to testify whether the particular material used was considered in the art to be leather?
If the level of skill in the art that's found is somebody who has experience in leather seats, then I would
agree. No, I'm saying that the level of skill in the art is someone who's been in the automobile industry, has a degree in automotive engineering, has had 10 years designing automobiles, to testify about whether a particular material is leather or not. An expert in leather might actually be able to testify more credibility about that issue than someone who has a more general expertise in automobile technology, right?
It's possible, and I think under SEB, that testimony, if it's helpful to the trier of fact, then that testimony should be permitted.
Okay, so what is it here that Pratt was testifying about? Put aside the doctrine of equivalence as to other infringement issues that was where he should have been excluded because he wasn't opposing.
So, for example, the lifter member is one of the terms that the chief administrative law judge relied on Dr. Pratt for understanding whether the lifting pins on the face surface of the accused product met the lifter member limitation. So that's one example of where the chief administrative law judge actually relied.
Why do you have to be an expert in power lifters to testify as to that?
Because Dr. Valley, Koki's expert, provided testimony explaining why one of ordinary skill in the art needed to have experience in power nailers. So one example is the recoil of the tool. Another example is the power cycle of the tool and the effect that the recoil, these are complicated tools. When the nailer, the nail comes out at a high pressure, it has some recoil and how that impacts the other components in the tool. So, for example, the lifter member limitation, whether those pins are on the face surface.
And what else do you think he was improperly allowed to testify about?
That's what the chief ALJ relied on Dr. Pratt for. In our view, he should also not have been able to provide testimony on obviousness, for example. Now, there may not be as much error there because I don't think the chief ALJ appeared to rely on Dr. Pratt's testimony, but the chief ALJ certainly relied on Dr. Pratt's testimony with respect to lifter member. And under Sundance, the law is that you need to be an expert in order to opine on patent issues.
Okay, so as to the 112.6 issue, how does that help you on infringement? I mean, I'm just wondering how this case comes out differently, whether it's 112.6 or not, because the structure described for the lifter member, even under a 112.6 theory, is still this lateral movement and the socket, whatever it is.
Yeah, so there's not evidence on the record because the claim construction came out and then the parties operated under the claim construction that was adopted.
Okay, but how does the case come out? I mean, you would have to agree that under a 112.6 analysis, this description of the lifter member in the specification is the corresponding structure, right?
Correct. And
so how does that help you then? I'm just not. What am I missing?
Yeah, so before the claim construction, when the parties had competing claim construction, Cokie had a non-infringement argument that it did not meet the lifter member limitation under if it were construed as 112 paragraph 6. The case would have to be remanded.
Why would that be true?
Because the...
I mean, you've got to show harmful error here. I'm just not understanding how saying that it should have been analyzed at 112.6 leads to a different result.
Yeah, so again, there's not evidence in the record because of what the parties operated. But to answer your question, Your Honor, Cokie's lifter member structure is different. It has two faces, and it has pins going from one face through one face to another face. It also engages the driver member in a different orientation than the lifter member that's disclosed in the asserted patents in this case. But there would have to be a remand.
I'm not sure that I understand how that helps you, because whether a lifter member is analyzed under the doctrine of equivalence as a not a 112.6 situation, or whether it's analyzed under 112.6, the same arguments about equivalence apply. What's the point here?
Well, the parties never got to whether Cokie's lifter member would be equivalent to if the lifter member were construed as 112 paragraph 6. Cokie had a non-infringement argument on literal infringement. I don't think, and again, it's not on the record, but I don't believe Kyocera ever made the argument that Cokie's lifter would have infringed under the doctrine of equivalence. So there's nothing in the record on that. That would have to be, again, expert testimony as to why Cokie's lifter member would not meet, or I'm sorry, Cokie's, the component in Cokie's tool would not meet the lifter member limitation if it were construed as a 112 paragraph.
Okay, I don't want to take all of your time. Go ahead.
Can I back up for 1 second to the expert? The expert in this case that you think should not have been allowed to offer testimony because he wasn't, at a minimum, a skilled artisan, am I understanding correctly that he offered testimony on claim construction, on infringement, literal, and then attempted on DOE, and also on obviousness?
Yes.
And so your view is that he should not have been allowed to offer any of that testimony?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Does that result in vacating and remanding this case? What is the result of, if we were to agree with you, the exclusion of that expert's testimony?
So for the 718 patent, it would result in remanding the case. For the other patents, the 296, the 297, the 722, the 282 patent, which were excluded, that would result in an affirmance.
Right. Because they were excluded because they were trying to prove it under DOE, and if we agreed it was correct, he couldn't give DOE testimony. That's just an affirm. So
right.
Only the 718 would be vacated and remanded. But can you tell me precisely what issues you believe we would be vacating and remanding for a new assessment of?
It would,
obviously, literal infringement is one of them, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. At a minimum, it would be literal infringement under the Chief Administrative Law Judge's holding on whether the accused products satisfy the face surface limitation of lifter member. Now, that's assuming that the court decides not to find lifter member is subject to 112 paragraph 6. If the court finds that lifter member is subject to 112 paragraph 6, there may be additional depending on the construction, on whether the accused products meet that particular.
But the only reliance on his testimony was in connection with this lifter member issue.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, hard for me to see why the remand could go beyond that.
For the Chief Administrative Law Judge relied solely on Dr. Pratt's testimony for that one, that particular limitation. Of course, the Chief Administrative Law Judge did rely on Dr. Pratt's testimony for obviousness and the other limitations as well, but there was additional evidence there that that the judge relied on as well. It wasn't solely Dr. Pratt's testimony.
Well, you don't think those things need to be vacated and remanded? The obviousness, for example, if one of the pieces of evidence that was relied upon was improper?
I think it should be. because that is, you know, the evidence may change if you don't have the battle of the experts anymore, right? You have one expert on one side analyzing the evidence in a particular way, and no expert on the other side analyzing the evidence for obviousness on a particular issue. And of course, obviousness is analyzed from the perspective of one of ordinary skill in the art.
Well, what precisely on obviousness did Dr. Pratt offer testimony on? What was the nature of his testimony as it pertained to obviousness?
So one example, and we raised this in our brief in connection with the commission's finding of obviousness based on the Pedicini reference. And the issue in Pedicini is whether it has a main storage chain. So there, Dr. Pratt testified as to whether that region above the piston is a would be considered a main storage chamber or not. On the other hand, Koki's expert, Dr. Valley, explained why that chamber is not a main storage chamber and why the construction of a volume is the displacement volume is only the volume in the main storage chamber limitation is anything outside of the displacement volume. So that's another area where the chief administrative law judge cited to Dr. Pratt's testimony in finding that the claims were not obvious.
Are there open factual issues for the experts to weigh in on with respect to 112 paragraph 6? You mentioned there was no evidence in the record. I just want to know if you're contending there are any open factual issues to be considered there.
Well, I think the factual issue would be, for example, whether, if it is 112 paragraph 6, whether the lifter member that's disclosed in the 718 patent is actually in the Koki products, if it's under the 112 paragraph 6.
If you don't mind, would you mind if I moved you to a different issue briefly?
Yes, Your Honor.
If I thought the commission erred by interpreting the safety contact as part of the fastener driver mechanism, what would be the impact on this case?
There would be no finding of infringement, Your Honor. The chief administrative law judge already found that there is no infringement because the fastener driving mechanism did not contact the work surface to initiate driving cycle. That finding was then reversed by the commission. But there was already a finding that Kyocera did not meet their burden of proof to show that that limitation was met.
When the trigger is activated, it would have to be, wouldn't it, that the driving member would be in contact with the surface? I mean, you wouldn't trigger the force when it was an inch or so above the surface, correct?
That's not true, Your Honor. You may have a little bit of space in between. So you have the safety contact element, and then you have the bottom of the fastener driving mechanism, which is a little bit higher. It's possible, and this is how Koki's tools operate, where when you initiate the safety contact element, there is a little bit of space in between the bottom of the fastener driving mechanism and the workpiece.
No. My question was when you trigger the pneumatic pressure, the driving mechanism is in contact with the surface, right?
No, it's not. Only
it's
the
not?
Safety contact element is. There's a little bit of space in between.
A little bit of space, okay.
While you're into your rebuttal time, would you like to save some?
Yes, please. Thank
okay.
you.
Mr. Garrett Dean. Oh, you're back there. No problem.
Good morning. May it please the court. Just turning first to the issue of Dr. Pratt's testimony. The commission did not abuse discretion here in excluding his testimony for proving infringement under the doctrine of equivalence. Consistent with the case precedent, the doctrine of equivalence, proving infringement of the doctrine of equivalence, requires particularized testimony from a person of ordinary skill in the art. Here it was undisputed that Dr. Pratt did not meet this level of power narrow design. However, on the other hand, regarding literal infringement and validity. The commission did not abuse its discretion in allowing in his testimony for those purposes. Rather, in the same precedent, describes that literal infringement is more of a straightforward, simple manner. And here it was okay. It was not abuse of discretion to allow in his testimony, presenting the accused products, the accused product literature, the relevant prior art for the ALJ and the commission to compare the claim limitations to this prior art or to the accused products, accused product literature to determine invalidity or literal infringement here. Let's turn into...
Before you turn, you don't think that's a little weird? That you allowed his testimony on literal infringement, which is from the vantage point of a skilled artisan, but did not allow his testimony from DOE, which is also from the vantage point of a skilled artisan. He's qualified under one and not the other?
Certainly I understand the question, Your Honor.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. I don't envy your position right now. I don't know how you can stand here and argue that this really disparate, split-the-baby sort of approach is a good idea for the law.
Yeah, I think the facts here are just very unique in this case.
But luckily for us, this isn't a factual question, is it? This isn't a factual question.
Right, it's an abuse of discretion.
And there's no question that he does not qualify as a skilled artisan, is that correct?
Right, as an ordinary skill in the art.
He does not have ordinary skill in the art.
Correct.
He absolutely does not have any years of working experience in the drive tool industry, which is required for a skilled artisan.
It was power narrow design.
He does not have any years of experience.
Right, correct. He admitted to that he didn't qualify.
Well, why did the commission distinguish between his testimony about doctrine of equivalence and his testimony about literal infringement? Why is he allowed to testify as to the latter but not the former?
I think it's the doctrine of equivalence, consistent with this court's precedent, again, requires a person of ordinary skill in the art to opine on the range of equivalence on a limitation basis. It has inherent complexities and difficulties that just aren't a part of literal infringement or invalidity or other issues. This is why it's required here and why, again, the facts of this case are very unique, where he excluded for that purpose of doctrine of equivalence, but permissible, not abusive discretion to allow in for literal infringement and invalidity. Again, here are the issues of literal infringement and invalidity. Again, we're comparing the accused product literature or the prior literature to the claim limitations, I think as stated by the ALJ at appendix pages 182 to 183, where they were able to make that comparison.
So how do you distinguish Sundance?
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
How do you distinguish Sundance?
Again, I think Sundance, again, didn't involve doctrine of equivalence. Here, doctrine of equivalence just has inherent complexities and difficulties that require that particularized testimony, as stated in Aquatex.
But Sundance does involve infringement and validity.
Correct, but...
And it says expressly that where an issue calls for consideration of evidence from the perspective of one of ordinary skill in the art, it is contradictory to Rule 702 to allow a witness to testify on the issue who is not qualified as a technical expert in that art.
Correct. Again, here, he did not meet the specialized nature of power nail design. He did have generalized fastener driving mechanism. Fastener driver tools experience. Again, it's very quirky facts here, I admit, but not abuse of discretion, sorry.
But it's not the facts that bother me. It's the failure to follow the law. I guess I thought in Sundance we made it really clear that to give testimony on infringement or validity, you had to, at a minimum, be an ordinarily skilled artisan. And he's not.
Right, that was admitted to, but again here, under the particular facts, the infringement here, the invalidity, what he provided, again, was little more than what the ALJ and Commission did here as fact finders in comparing the accused product literature, the accused products to the claim limitations at issue. Again, it stated in those pages 182, 183, that he was able to do it for multiple claim limitations to basically make that comparison and make the determination of infringement. I think this issue was pretty well covered in our briefing.
Well, is your theory that his testimony on literal infringement wasn't related necessarily to power nail drivers and concerned more generally things that he was an expert in?
I just think, again, under the unique facts of this case, it was more of a straightforward, simpler approach, just comparing the claim limitations to the accused products, accused like literature, and the prior art literature in this case. That he was able to make that comparison as a fact finder.
Here's the problem in this case. It's not your problem. The problem in this case is that one of the parties messed up here by not objecting and or rejecting the level of skilled art that was proffered by Kyocera. And once that had become binding in the case, you live and die by your own litigation choices. You know, that, I mean, we ought not to mess up the entire law because one party screwed up and accepted a fact-finding on the level of skill in the art that probably isn't exactly the right fact-finding here. I mean, I'll tell you what, I'd have let Dr. Pratt testify, but I wouldn't have ever agreed to that level of skill in the art. And once they agreed to it, he's out. And that's the way I see it. It's hard for me to see it any other way than that. And I really think that what you're asking me to do to uphold would mess up the law really badly. And it would create the mischief and havoc that I tried very hard in Sundance to eliminate.
I understand the court's perspective on this. Again, I think it's covered pretty well in our briefs that there was a distinction here, not abuse of discretion, and excluding it for doctrine of equivalence, but allowing it in for literal infringement, given under the particular lens of this case and the issues here.
Well, do you want to reach it? Are there any other issues you wanted to cover today?
Oh, yeah, sure. Turning to the issue of driven position, again, Kyocera's counsel makes the argument that somehow the second embodiment broadens the scope of the term driven position. However, again, the language mirrors each other. If you look at appendix pages 355, column 12, lines 56 through 65, it states, in this configuration, the displacement of volume 76 and the main storage chamber 74 are at their largest combined volumes, while the cylinder venting chamber 94 is at its minimum volume. Turning to the corresponding written description for figure 20, the second embodiment, again, it's pretty much mirrored. Appendix page 362, column 26, lines 43 through 53. And in this configuration, displacement volume 457 and the main storage chamber 454 are at their largest combined volumes, while the cylinder venting chamber 492 is at its minimum volume. Again, the exact same configuration for both figures, figure 3 and figure 20, the first embodiment, second embodiment, indicating that driven position is consistently defined as the bottommost travel position or the bottom position has the same exact configuration for the tool.
Mr. Carradine, would you mind if I asked you to address the Commission's position on lifter member? And in particular, what do you think should – suppose that this panel found it was a 112.6 term, okay? We disagreed with the Commission's finding and say it is a 112.6 term. What should happen then in this case? I think Judge Dyke was asking some questions about whether it would actually have any impact on the outcome or not. Does it create fact issues that the Commission would need to look at in the first instance?
Argue vehemently that should not be the case. If that was the case, issue should be remanded.
I don't understand what the difference is here. If it's literal infringement, the theory is this part of the specification describes what a lifter member is, and if it's 112.6, the corresponding structure is the same thing. What difference does it make?
I think if you go to appendix pages 178 to 179, where the ALJ goes over the testimony from each expert, it explains that the lifting pins for the accused products are on an interface, and basically the plane of the driver teeth.
Okay, but that's not really answering my question. My question is, if it's literal infringement this part of the specification describes what the lictor member is. If it's 112.6, the same part of the specification describes what the corresponding structure is. What difference does it make whether it's 112.6 or literal infringement? It's the same structure in either event.
Right. It would have to be some. There was no finding there on infringement or doctrine.
Well, it doesn't require a finding. I mean, it's the same portion of the specification. One that says this defines what it is for purposes of literal infringement, and the other one is this is the corresponding structure for 112.6. It's the same thing in either event.
Right, again, the accused product and the patent are a little different structurally. They would have to be a remand for analysis just to determine that there was the equivalence found in that instance.
So to make sure I understand your argument, you're saying it's a factual question. While the claim construction may be literal, may be a question of law, and when you look, if this is 112.6, at what the corresponding structure is, that's a question of law. But under literal infringement, whether something's equivalent to that structure is a question of fact, and the commission has not yet addressed
that. Correct. That was never addressed since it wasn't.
And so the commission needs to address that.
Correct.
Okay.
Again, I would argue vehemently that that should not be the case. Here, the patentee first recited structure in the claim itself. It recited structural components that the lifter member is interconnected to, a prime mover and a driver member. Also, the patentee acts as his own lexicographer in specification, defining over and over that lifter member is a rotary telinary lifter as the rotating structural component, and then and having a second structural component of a face with lifter pins. This is throughout the specification.
Do you have any other questions for the government?
Okay. Quick point on initiating the driving cycle.
Sure, I'll give you a minute to address it. You're way over your time, but go for it. If you want to address it, go for it.
Okay, again, I would stress again, consistent throughout specifications, particularly for the second embodiment, it's consistently defined that the safety contact element is part of the tool. It's an extension of the bottom of the tool. The exit portion of the...
Why is it the exit end? It may be certainly part of the tool, but why is it the exit end?
That's how it's expressly defined.
The exit end would be the driving mechanism.
Right, that's not how it's described in the specification. I think if you go through both embodiments, particularly if you go through appendix page, it's going to be... 564, columns 11, line 60 through column 12, line 18.
Well, tell me what part of the specification tells me the exit end isn't the driving mechanism, that it's the safety mechanism.
It's all throughout the specification, particularly. If you go to the second embodiment, at appendix page, it's going to be 571.
571.
Column 26, lines 10 through 39. Right, I think in the middle of that section there, it says two independent actions must occur in a specific order. These two actions are pressing the nose of the safety contact element against the solid surface and depressing the trigger actuator. The trigger actuator will cause the trigger switch 437 to change state, which is one condition that will start sending current to the motor 427. The safety contact element 418 has an upper arm 434 that would be moved as the nose 419 is pushed into the tool 401, and this upper arm will actuate another sensor, which in the illustrated embodiment is a small limit switch.
It doesn't even use the term exit end, right?
Right, but it defines it earlier that this extension, the safety contact element, is part of the exit portion of the faster driving mechanism. And that's defined at shown in figure 16, also defined at 568, column 20, line 7 through 17. This whole bottom portion includes the exit end of the faster driving mechanism, the extension of the safety contact element, which has a nose, and it's depressing that nose against the workpiece that initiates the driving cycle.
I guess one of the things, when we talk about exit end of the mechanism, I don't see how that isn't the exit end of the tool.
Right, but it defines the safety contact element as part of the tool. So
right, so the exit end of the mechanism has to be the exit end of the tool, right?
Well, again, in that section in those figures, 568, column 20, lines 7 through 17, it's defining a whole bottom portion of that tool. Right, so basically defines that, yeah, the area of the second embodiment, tool 401, which a fastener is released, is indicated approximately by the reference number 417, which is the bottom of the fastener exit portion.
So, counsel, here's kind of part of my problem with this particular construction, is that the parties agreed that the word mechanism refers to fastener driver mechanism. I don't think that's right. I don't think it can possibly be right in light of Claim 9, the dependent claim, which refers for antecedent basis back. It says said exit end of the tool. It can only be referring to the end of the mechanism itself, i.e. the whole tool, not just the end of the fastener driver means. So what does this court do in a situation where the parties stipulate the word mechanism refers to one thing, but the claim language to me means it's referring to something else?
Right, I don't think there's really a disconnect here, because again, the spec refers to an exit portion, which encompasses this exit end. All these elements are part of the bottom of the tool, the safety contact element, the exit end of the faster driving mechanism. That's all part of the tool. It's all this bottom portion referred to in these figures 1 and figure 16, which is consistent in supporting the claim language. So that you cannot divorce the safety contact element from the rest of the tool. It's all part of it, and that's consistent with the claim language.
Okay. Anything further? Okay, thank you, counsel.
Okay.
We have some rebuttal time. Mr. Shulman, you have 2 minutes left, but we'll restore your whole 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Moore, I'm going to try to make you comfortable that you're not going to ruin the law.
I know I'm not going to ruin the law.
I'm going to try to make you comfortable that if you rule in our favor, you're not going to ruin the law. Your Honor, the expert testimony is reviewed for abuse of discretion. And the question is whether or not a particular expert can testify from the perspective of one having ordinary skill in the art. And even in Sundance, what the court said is it is abuse of discretion to permit a witness to testify as an expert on the issues of infringement or invalidity unless that witness is qualified as an expert in the pertinent art. Not unless that expert is a person having ordinary skill in the art, but whether they are qualified as an expert, which a district court or the commission reviews and has discretion to determine after review, seeing everything about the expert. There's a reason why the district courts and commissions have discretion. The district court could have looked at Dr. Pratt, and indeed did, for purposes of literal infringement, and said, look, he's got a lot of experience in pneumatic fastener drivers, not necessarily power nailers, but pneumatic fastener drivers. And I believe, as the chief ALJ said, that he could testify from the perspective of one of ordinary skill in the art. To affirm that would not wreck the law in any way, shape, or form. What you would be doing is reaffirming that district courts and the commission have discretion to allow experts to testify if the district court believes that they could testify from the perspective of one having ordinary skill in the art. And Judge Moore, as you said, I believe, not to put words in your mouth, but I believe you said you would have let him testify, which reflects the fact.
But I also said I never would have agreed to the level of skill in the art. You screwed up. You accepted a level of skill in the art that excluded your own expert. You must have been shocked when that happened and you came to that realization.
Our understanding, Your Honor, was that the literal level of ordinary skill in the art is not the litmus test for expert testimony.
That cannot possibly be your understanding. That's absurd.
Your Honor,
knew it was the level for Aquatex. Is there any, there's no room in Aquatex. You gotta be at least a level, an ordinarily skilled artisan, at least to offer that particularized testimony. You knew that. And you had to know it because Aquatex is crystal clear. What you've asked this court to do is overrule binding precedent, which we can't do. And so then now you're sort of out of luck. It ruled out four patents because you didn't have expert testimony on them.
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't believe Aquatex holds that the person has to be literally or even at a minimum a person of ordinary skill in the art. What Aquatex says and what SEB says and what other cases have said is that the person must be qualified to testify from the perspective of a person having ordinary skill in the art. And given the abuse of discretion standard, when somebody has the educational requirement and an experience in clearly an adjacent area, pneumatic fastener drivers for rivets versus power nailers, it is not an abuse of discretion to allow that person to testify. And it is abuse of discretion to when that decision is based on a clearly erroneous view of the law, and the chief ALJ viewed Aquatex as the word of, requiring that the expert literally be a person of ordinary skill in the art, was not correct. This court has never said, even if you take at face value that it had to be a minimum, which I don't believe this court has ever said, it's never said the expert must literally be a person having ordinary skill in the art. That ruling was based on a clear error of law. That is abuse of discretion, and there is no wrecking of the law. It is completely consistent with Aquatex and with Sundance to say somebody who had experience in fastener, pneumatic fastener drivers could testify from that perspective.
Do you agree it can possibly be okay for the ITC to split the baby like they did here to exclude him from offering DOE testimony while allowing him to testify on literal infringement? Or do you believe in assessing an expert's qualifications, it probably ought to be all or nothing?
I believe it should have been all or nothing. I believe it should have been all or nothing in him being in because he was qualified to testify. I want to address, Judge Dyke, you asked a question about the lifter member relied on by Pratt. In Appendix 178 and 179, the commission says, the crux of the dispute is whether the lifting pins of the pinwheel are on its face surface. So that was the lifter member. It wasn't a complicated question, as my friend suggests. It was a very simple question. Are the lifting pins on the face surface? And Dr. Pratt's testimony, whether he was literally one of ordinary skill in the art, the issue wasn't so complicated that he couldn't testify as to whether the lifting pins were on the face. And in fact, the ALJ relied on drawings from Dr. Valley's presentation. And again, this is all in Appendix 178 and 179, what they relied on. And he relied on a manufacturing schematic from the Koki tool. He cited RX0214C. So it wasn't just Dr. Pratt's
testimony. Can I ask you
to
address, just briefly, because we're beyond your time, but if the safety contact and the fastener driver mechanism are potentially separate components, what happens to this case?
If they are separate components, well, then the court affirms on the cross appeal because the exit end of the tool is a safety contact element. And if you look at, again, Appendix 526 to 527, again, Judge Dyke, you asked about, well, can it be triggered by the fastener driver?
Are you sure you don't mean reverse? You said the court affirms. I'm pretty sure you mean the court reverses, right?
Affirms on the cross appeal because that refers to Koki's appeal. If the court finds a safety that initiating the driving member is correct, then we prevail on the 718 patent. And I just wanted to point out to you, Judge Dyke, in Figures 13A and 13B. Of Appendix 526 and 527, it shows that the trigger is triggered by the actuation of the safety contact element. I know it's a flow chart, but you'll see in the diamond shapes, the safety contact element is what triggers driving. And we identify in pages 27
and 28. I think that maybe you misunderstood my question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
If I don't think the district court or the ITC got the safety contact element construction right, what happens to this case?
I'm struggling with that, Your Honor, because the question is what is the exit end of the tool? And the safety contact element is at the exit end of the tool. So the question that the commission asked is what is the exit end of the tool? The commission found that the exit end of the tool is at safety contact. It's number, and so in the drawing that, in fact, the Koki has in their brief, it's 419, the part that actually touches the tool. If
I think what Judge Moore is asking is, what relief do we grant if we agree that the ITC erred in this respect?
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't hear the second part of your question.
If the ITC erred with respect to the exit end construction, what do we do? Does that mean there is non-infringement?
Well, I believe there would have to be a remand then, because there was then this court would have to issue a claim construction that has never been tried. You'd be asking, because again, the safety contact element is not the claim limitation. The claim limitation is exit end of the tool. I don't know what this court would construe exit end to mean. And if it's a brand new construction,
okay.
I suppose we'd have to.
So your idea is if we disagree with the commission's construction, the appropriate course of action would be to vacate and remand.
Depending on how you disagree with it, yes.
Well, okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Shulman. Mr. Parikh, I'll restore your 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. So to answer your last question, if this court finds that the exit end of the mechanism is what's required to contact the work surface in order to initiate the driving cycle, this court should reverse. My colleague said that the claim uses the phrase exit end of the tool. That's not correct. Judge Moore, you recognize the...
Claim 9 does, right? Or
Claim 11.
Claim 9 does, but Claim 1, the asserted claim, uses the phrase from an exit end of the mechanism, and the parties agreed that the mechanism in that limitation refers to the fastener driving mechanism, not the tool.
Claim 9 is not an asserted claim.
Claim 9 is not an asserted claim. But Claim 9 actually, and we address this in our brief, if the patentee wanted to use the phrase exit end of the tool, they knew how to use the phrase exit end of the tool. But that's not what they used in Claim 1. In Claim 1, they specifically chose to use exit end of the mechanism, which the parties agreed is exit end of the fastener driving mechanism. And the claim specifically identifies that the fastener driving mechanism is just the hollow cylinder and the main storage chamber. And then it separately recites the safety contact element as a separate limitation, which is also consistent with the specification. I believe the ITC pointed you to a part of the specification where it talks about the exit end of the tool. But there's another part of the specification, Appendix 568, which differentiates between the bottom of the fastener exit portion of the tool, or the fastener driving mechanism, and the bottom of the safety contact element. What Claim 1 is directed to is there's a logic flow diagram at Appendix 575, column 33, lines 42 to 47, and there it says the step determines whether or not the safety contact element has been pressed against a solid object to an extent that actuates a sensor, which means that the tool is now pressed against the surface. And what it's referring to there, the tool being pressed against the surface, is the bottom of the fastener driving mechanism, not the bottom of the safety contact element. So we don't dispute that you have to actuate the safety contact element. The question is, how far does the safety contact element have to be actuated? And in Claim 1, it refers to this embodiment where the tool itself, the fastener driving mechanism, has to be in contact with the work surface in order to actuate the driving mechanism. And with that, I see my time is up, so unless the panel has any additional questions.
Okay, nope. We thank all counsel. This case is taken under submission.